Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome back to the Toe Meets Leather podcast. I'm Logan, here with all your relevant college football and pro basketball information. Andrew, why don't you tell us how many rings the Zen Master has?
He has 11, which is two more than Red Auerbach with 9, so he has the most for any coach in NBA history.
He also has, what, 9 more than LeBron? So that clearly makes him the superior basketball player.
A lot of people have more than LeBron.
And we also have Tommy on the line. How are you doing today, Tommy?
I'm all right.
I know you're disappointed with how Tampa Bay finished off the season, but they're looking good. They got a lot of wins there at the end of the year.
They fired their damn coach.
Which will never make any sense to me.
I don't want to talk about it.
And sadly, Nigel will not be joining us today. He was too busy skipping leg day, so we will have to see him another time.
Whoa. You better not be skipping leg day. That's my New Year's resolution. I ain't failing on that this year.
All I do is skip arm day now. It's all leg days all the time.
And soon you'll be buffer than Nigel could ever dream. Oh. Crush a man's skull between your thighs. All right, guys, let's get down to the actual college football, what we're supposed to talk about here. So the big game was last night. I was pretty pleased overall with how it turned out. It was definitely more exciting than last year. A real back-and-forth matchup. It didn't play out quite the way I thought it did, but it reminded me a lot of the Rocky movies. There was a bunch of back-and-forth play, and Clemson fought hard, went the distance, but right there at the end, they just couldn't hold up on the scoreboard. Got beat on special teams. Tommy, I'm going to start with you because I know you've got some choice words. Why don't you go ahead and tell us what you thought about the game?
Well, I'm going to start off with the usual transitive property here, because if you actually follow the transitive property, you have Alabama is better than Clemson because they beat Clemson 45-40. But if you really think about it, Clemson's better than Alabama because they beat Florida State, who beat Florida, who beat Mississippi, who beat Alabama, for a combined total score of 131-62. So just keep that in mind. Transitive property rules. As far as the game itself last night, yeah, we were kind of talking about that earlier. I think the officials completely blew it. I think this was worse than most of those Pac-12 after dark games that we see every year where the officials just don't seem to understand what the rules are, or they arbitrarily decide which rules they're going to enforce and who they're going to be against. Luckily, I think they pretty much let it go both ways, so I don't think that neither team really got an advantage off of poor officiating. But then again, I'm always of the opinion that if the rules are there, you need to enforce them. I mean, showing how many times Shaq Lawson was clearly offsides, and he was called out on all 4 channels covering last night. So if 4 sets of announcers can point it out, I'm sure one of the 5 guys on the field can point it out. I mean, it was like 4 times in a row in the first quarter alone. Not to mention there was a bunch of contact downfield that they seemed to arbitrarily throw pass interference. It didn't seem like they were calling one way or the other. Also, if you look on I think it was the second drive of the game, an Alabama player actually threw a punch and hit a Clemson guy in the face mask. So, not to say one way or the other that one team was necessarily playing by the rules more than the other, but I just think the officials let things play out in a way that's not necessarily what the rules are and what everybody prepares for every week. So I was very disappointed in the game and didn't even finish watching it because of that.
The thing is with refs, especially in college football, there are going to be plays that they just miss calls on. That stuff happens. Like you said, a lot of it was back and forth. The one that drove me absolutely insane was at the end of the half where Clemson was driving. They got the first down and the refs just decided to, for whatever reason, to let the clock run and make Clemson waste a timeout while they were well on their way to getting closer to making a field goal. And I can't say for certain that if they had gotten closer, they would have made that field goal, But it certainly didn't help that the refs screwed up the one essential part of being a college football ref, which is stopping the clock when you get a first down. That drove me insane. And like you said, it's not – because a lot of these went back and forth, so I don't mind it if it's even. But when you're actively screwing a team out of points like that, I don't care who I'm cheering for. I want to see a good game where both teams put up a good fight, not a game where the refs screw a team out of points. And that really pissed me off. But as far as the play on the field, though, getting back to the actual people out there, again, I was really impressed. I think Nigel would have been happy if he was here to talk about how great Deshaun Watson did out there. Andrew, do you want to put some words out there for him?
Yeah, I think Watson really put himself as not only into the easy conversation as possibly 1A or 1B or 1C in terms of the Heisman discussion next year. I think it sets up well that he will very, very likely, barring insanity, be the number one pick in the 2017 NFL draft. He made some throws the other night that were just unbelievable throws, especially for a sophomore at the college level. The wheel route to Renfro for the first touchdown, the defensive back played it right. They switched it off. He carried it. He was relatively in position to make a play, and Watson just put it exactly where he had to. You know, same thing with the second touchdown. Now, that one, the safety made the mistake on that one. He showed outside leverage. I'm sure Watson saw it. He and the receiver could tell. Receiver took one hard step out. You're telling that safety to defend the corner route. He takes one hard step out, bites back inside on the post, and Watson puts it exactly where he had to for only his guy to make a play. You know, and then you just saw how deadly of a weapon Watson's feet were in terms of keeping the play alive, in terms of scrambling to pick up yardage when the play broke down. You know, I think the biggest thing to me all game was just the poor play of both offensive lines. Both of them broke down way too easily, too much free rein in the backfield for both defensive lines. You know, it gives you negative plays. It takes you off schedule on offense. It can really impact. You know, neither team really ran the ball that well. You know, I mean, yeah, Henry averaged 4.4 yards a carry, but yards per carry is really kind of a weird stat because it doesn't really tell you the whole picture of what the guy's doing. And Clemson just got away from the run game completely, as you started to see later in the game. But yeah, I mean, Watson probably was the most impressive. Watson or O.J. Howard, the tight end in Alabama, were two of the most impressive guys to me on the offensive side of the ball in that game. Getting back to talking about officials, I don't know if you got a chance, but I loved what ESPN did with the film room version, where they brought in Fedora, Muschamp, Narduzzi, McElwain, and Willie Taggart from South Florida to sit and watch the game and really just talk about it and break it down and comment on it. And it was interesting to watch Narduzzi, who brought up a lot of questions that defensive coaches always have in terms of why is my guy not considered a defensive player when he gets a crackback and he can't see it? And, you know, you had the call on the Clemson offensive lineman for lineman downfield that a lot of these style offenses, that's how they teach it. They teach the linemen to run block, basically. And if you're downfield, you're downfield. And if the guy's not going to call it, we're going to run the play. And then the other one that really stood out to me, and you don't see this called because it's a bit of a gray area, but if you start looking at these offensive lines, you'll see the centers on the ball, and then you'll see guard and tackles that are half a yard. Yeah, I mean, they're almost, you could argue, in the backfield and not actually on the line of scrimmage, which creates a lot of different ideas in terms of they can get more push, they can get a little more room to get some momentum, they're not having to fire off immediately, you know, straight hands up into the tackle or into the end. But it can also backfire because it gives the end and the tackle a little more room to stunt, a little more room to play with their hands, and you're not able to get up on them as quickly. So it's got its goods and its bad, but it's just an interesting to listen to a defensive coach, especially one as well-respected as Narduzzi, point out a lot of these things that you sit here and you go, well, that's an interesting question. if you're going to call the receiver across the middle who doesn't see the hit defenseless, why aren't you calling the same thing on a crackback when the guy is as defenseless, if not more, because he's not, you know, his eyes aren't the same. They're not on the hit like they are with a lot of these wide receivers. But yeah, I mean, I loved it. I think ESPN did a great job. The big thing too to me is neither defense really showed up the way we expected them to. You know, I mean, it was a higher scoring game, a lot of yards, and then a lot of plays, especially great plays for Alabama, were made on mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, and you look
I would have to agree and disagree with you there, because I think both defenses did show up and played well. I just think that the mistakes that happened when they were glaring and put a lot of yards up, because, you know, they even made the comment, Derrick Henry's average dropped from like 6.7 to 3.2 in the first half if you take away that one touchdown run. So I think it was pretty good football all around. It's just when the mistakes happen against a team as talented, regardless of who was on defense, they're going to exploit it, and they did.
The way I looked at it was both teams clearly had a focus on defense, and that was getting in the backfield, stopping the running back before they could get to the line, and putting pressure on the quarterback. That actually worked in Clemson's favor because it allowed Watson to scramble around. But really, as far as Clemson's defense, that's where you saw a lot of their faltering, partially because of the injuries in the secondary. When they ended up putting the pressure on Coker, he ran into some situations where there was just people wide open in the secondary and he could pass to them and score. And that falls down to what Andrew was talking about. There were mistakes all over in the secondary on both sides of the ball, and that's what led to a lot of the points. So I would say, yeah, I think both teams executed where they thought it was important to, but that also left open some gaping holes on their on both defenses.
Well, but even that, sometimes you can have busted plays where no one's punished. I think you look at, and this kind of showed me where you could still tell that Watson was a bit of a sophomore on his interception. They ran a very, very common route out of the bunch. They wheeled number three. They ran the spot route with number one, and two ran the post. And if you go and watch it, the spot was wide open.
Yeah.
The defensive back that was supposed to take the in-breaking spot route, he went with a guy. They had two guys taking the wheel. And for whatever reason, Watson decided to throw the wheel and threw in a double coverage. Though if you're grading the tape, you look at the guy that made the interception, and you can tell, obviously, he's supposed to be on the spot route. So he'd get a bust, but he made the play. So, you know, it's always interesting when you start to look at it at that level where even if mistakes are made, sometimes it's covered up by great plays or by mistakes by the offense.
I mean, at the end of the day, I think the reason the game was close was a combination of Clemson's offense and Deshaun Watson distributing the ball and his receivers making him look even better than he was playing, and he was already playing on such a high level. And then I think Lane Kiffin knowing what he needed to get done, and I think he outcoached Venables in the second half. And I think it showed on some of the plays and the busted coverages and stuff, because if you watch the plays leading up to a lot of them, he'll run up the middle, run up the middle, run up the middle, and then all of a sudden he throws a bunch screen route on the outside where, you know, the one guy lines up for the screen, the other one flies, and there's only one corner out there because they're stacking the box. So I think Lane Kiffin is the reason Alabama won in the second half by out-coaching Venables, and it showed. But I think the score was close because of the level that Deshaun Watson and his receivers were playing.
Well, and really quick, I want to bring up a topic that ESPN's been talking about a lot. There's actually been two topics, but I'll start with this one. We talked about this immediately following the game, the morning of it, rather. Is Henry going to make it in the NFL the way that he runs? And, I mean, I don't have a question about Deshaun Watson because Deshaun Watson looked great in that game. But, obviously, everybody's kind of wondering, as far as it goes, Henry's the Heisman. Do you think it's going to transfer well to the NFL? Andrew, I'll start with you. What are your thoughts?
I see a lot of a DeMarco Murray and his move to Philadelphia kind of situation with Derrick Henry. I think if he gets into a team that's got a solid offensive line, that's going to, you know, two back or one back and run downhill, not ask him to make a lot of cuts in the backfield, I think he can be a serviceable running back in the NFL. I don't think he's going to be a great one. You know, I don't see him. I personally wouldn't draft him any higher than maybe the third or the fourth round, because I think he's going to be a very one-dimensional type running back. I don't think you're going to get a lot out of him in terms of the passing game. You know, I think he might be a good third down back because he's a little bit bigger, so he might be better at picking up some of those blitzing linebackers. But, I don't think he's going to play a role in the screen game, and I don't see him being successful, you know, in a place like Philadelphia was, where you go from downhill runs, hit the hole, see it, you know, one cut, one step, and get vertical, as opposed to a lot of that gun run where you've got to take it, plant, you see the hole, you move a little bit. And I think that's the biggest thing that killed DeMarco Murray. You know, I don't think DeMarco Murray all of a sudden went from being the rushing leader to a no-talented bum. I think he just went into a system that really didn't play well to what he was good at. And I think that's actually a common thing you see with free agency in the NFL sometimes. You have guys coming off great years in one system. They get these great contracts to go to and end up playing in a different system or even a different role and aren't able to be as successful because it's not a system that plays well to what they're good at.
And, Tommy, something you actually talked about was Drake might be the better of the two backs just because he is more versatile. You can use him in more locations.
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking about the NFL, though, I don't see Kenyon Drake as a running back, though. I think he's fits more into a wide receiver role, possibly more the slot stuff, something along the lines of like a Julian Edelman type role. So not as much of a running back, but I definitely think that next year Alabama's still going to be fine.
I disagree with you. I think Kenyon Drake's going to be a bigger Darren Sproles type player. I think he's got the same kind of shiftiness, the speed, and the great hands. But he's 6'1", 6'even", 210. So, I mean, he's a lot bigger and a lot thicker than Darren Sproles. And I think he's got a chance. Again, you know, it's a lot of it, too, is where you go and the style they run and what they asked you to do. But I honestly, the only question you keep asking about him, and it's really not Kenyon Drake's fault, is he was injured a lot. You know, I mean, broken bones are broken bones. That's not so much an injury prone. It's just bad luck, really. But honest to goodness, if I'm a GM, I'd take Kenyon Drake before I take Derrick Henry because I think Drake contributes more to your team, both as a return man, as a running back, and with hands out of the backfield in the screen game or any other kind of passing game you want to build around a running back. I'm also sitting on my bed doing a podcast and not in an NFL front office, so take that for what it's worth.
Yet.
True.
Yeah. Hey, you never know, okay? The man in the hoodie could come calling any second. Oh. No, not you, Tommy.
You got your sleeves on, though. You didn't cut your sleeves off randomly at the elbow.
Jacket's too expensive to cut the sleeves off. I ain't made of money.
You're also not filming the Kansas City locker room right now. That got a lot more sensual than I thought it would. Anyway, I don't think Clemson in this game has anything to be disappointed about. They went out there and fought like crazy. And they actually had a lot of injuries. So if you're a Clemson fan, you might even be saying, you know, if we didn't have those injuries, if we didn't have a couple of bad calls by the refs, we might have won this game. But the past is in the past. So I'm going to bring up the other thing that ESPN is talking about, because that's the big news source. Saban, he won another national championship. Is he the greatest of all time? Personally, I don't think he is, but I want to hear your thoughts. Tommy, I'll start with you this time.
I mean, I think we're splitting hairs talking about the greatest coach of all time. I mean, he's got the titles to prove it. He's got the sustained success, and he's won everywhere he's been as long as it's in college. So I mean, is he? Is he not? It doesn't matter. He's one of the best to ever coach the game. So, and he's proven that it wasn't just a fluke or a short run of great recruiting that won him the first set. I mean, he's doing it every year. So,
all right, Andrew, is he better than LeBron James?
I mean, obviously, he's better than LeBron James. He's got more rings.
And that's the only stat you need, Sean.
You know, I with Saban, I think a lot of it really depends on how he took what happened in Miami. If it was, I'm in the NFL, I don't like it, I don't like how it's different, I don't like dealing with millionaires versus dealing with players. You know, it's, that's a really thing to me. And from what I've seen of Nick Saban, I don't really see him going back to the NFL. I think he's got a great deal going with what he does and where he is at Alabama. I think he's happy. I think he you know, and the thing about a lot of these coaches too, especially the college level, is they're as much teachers and mentors as they are coaches. And depending on how important that is to a coach, that will obviously play a huge role in whether or not they truly look at jumping to the NFL. And I just, from what I've seen from Saban, I don't see him making that jump, especially because, I mean, the bigger issue, too, is if you're making that jump in the NFL, you're probably going to a team that's not very good.
Yeah,
the only place Saban goes is Texas if he goes anywhere, and I think the chance of that happening is about 1 in 100 million. So,
you know, before they hired Charlie Strong a couple of years ago, I thought it was really, really high. I thought Saban had a strong chance of going to Texas. But I really kind of think that ship has sailed, in that even if Strong fails this next year and they get rid of him, I don't think Texas necessarily looks at Saban as much as they did the last time.
Well, the only reason I could think that he would leave is if somebody paid him significantly more. And yeah, Texas would be the only program I can think of that could actually pull that off.
Texas, Notre Dame, Southern California, that's it.
But I don't think he goes to Notre Dame. I don't think Southern Cal looks at him, so.
Yeah. Texas is the only one, and
I just don't see it.
He's not going anywhere for, well, until he decides to retire is what I'm getting at. But I think
he still needs to get a statue bigger than Bear Bryant built for him, so he's got work to do, right?
That's the bottom.
What did the Bear have, 6 or 7 national titles?
Oh, God, what was it? 6.
6?
So they're tied right now.
Saban needs 2 more?
I thought he was at 6 right now. No, you're right.
Saban tied him.
Well, but how many does he have at Alabama?
No, you're right. Yeah. He's only got
4 at Alabama.
Yeah.
Yep.
Then he's only got 5 because he only won 1 at LSU.
In Michigan State, right?
He never won a national title. Oh, he actually never had better than, I think, an 8-win season at Michigan State.
But he's that good of a coach. We all just assume that he won a national title at Michigan State.
Well, but I mean, you could argue the same thing when his first year at Kent State.
No, it is 5. You're right. It is 5.
But no, so I guess that is the comparison that all Bama fans are going to make, though, is, is he as good as Bear Bryant? And I think it's just a different age right now that we live in. You can't really call.
Saban deals with a lot of things Bryant never had to deal with.
He also can't hide players like Bryant was able to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, he can't recruit 100-something kids into his program that are all scholarship kids and cut them when fall camp starts, but keeps them from playing for other teams.
There's the racial issue that gets brought up. There's the over-recruiting issue. There's the, personally, I like
injury
this.
Injury cut to open up more space.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Injuring other players. There's the my favorite.
Bag men are a lot more underground than they ever were during Bryant's time.
My favorite was the death squad he had over at Texas A&M, even though it wasn't at Bama. That was my favorite.
So Saban's records at Michigan State, he was 6-5-1, 6-6, 7-5, 6-6. His last year was 9-2, and he left before the bowl game to take the LSU job.
So what you're saying is he was bad at some point.
Yeah, I mean, he was mediocre. I mean, he wasn't bad. He made 4 bowl games. He never had a losing season. He had 2 6-6s, a 7-5, and a 6-5.
But Michigan State, when he was there, is not the Michigan State.
No, they're not at all. I mean,
that was definitely a building job.
Oh, very much. Especially because he was coming off having gotten fired from the Cleveland Browns with Butch Davis. Belichick. He was with Belichick in his first NFL stint in Cleveland, and he was the defensive coordinator. Which, interesting enough, Belichick actually had the best record in Cleveland since whoever their super famous coach was, Paul Brown, had retired. And Belichick, I believe, made the playoffs 1 year in Cleveland, but he still got fired.
Because Cleveland's terrible, and I don't care who knows it. Anyway, yeah, I think it's good to know the coaches are human. We're going to go ahead and move on to our next segment, though. End of the story. Saban won another national championship at the end of the year. Now the college football season is over, and I am sad. It breaks my heart. Well, I'm not that sad. Georgia Tech had a terrible year. I was kind of waiting for this, honestly.
Revenge Tour, 2K16. We finally got the start that we needed. Knocked off number 4, Virginia.
Notre Dame, look out. We're coming tomorrow.
I ain't scared of no touchdown Jesus. Or I don't really know what that signal means in basketball, but
Free throw Jesus.
Oh no. Yeah. This is what's become of us. We now have to be excited about basketball. Oh my gosh. But yeah, just to sum up the season, why don't y'all kind of give me a ranking, what y'all thought of the season, and give me something that really excited you this season, the thing that makes you most excited. Andrew, I'll start with you, because I think I might have a guess as to what you're the most excited about this season.
Well, you know, like I said, Georgia Tech pretty much took a couple years off the end of my life due to the damage that I've done to my liver. You know, it's another great, exciting season. I think the biggest thing to me is there weren't nearly as many surprises as you would have thought. You know, we ended up with 4 teams in the playoff that if you had said at the beginning of the season, these were the 4 teams in the playoff, no one really would have fought you on it. You know, I think seeing the great defensive turnaround that Gene Chizik did at North Carolina up until the Baylor game was a great thing to see. You know, Baylor and TCU kind of keep their run going, as well as Oklahoma getting back to the level that they're used to being at. I think it was exciting to see Oklahoma State hit a level they really haven't seen. You know, Mike Leach putting together a strong bowl team at Washington State. The parity you saw in the Pac-12 South was really exciting, and to see USC kind of rally together after losing Sarkisian and then end up winning the South was a fantastic story. You know, to see Iowa string together an undefeated season after Kirk Ferentz being on the hot seat, Northwestern being the next best team on that side, only losing 2 games.
The Big Ten came around in some unusual ways, that's for sure. I think the thing that got me most excited, and I wasn't surprised that Andrew brought up UNC, but the thing that got me most excited was all the crazy ends to a lot of football games. Georgia Tech had that big one at homecoming against FSU. People forget that was homecoming, but that was probably the most exciting play of the year for us. Duke losing against Miami on that last second Music Bowl miracle kind of play. That was crazy.
And don't forget the Michigan State game.
How could you? It's like I think
those are another couple stories. You look at Florida with a brand new coach coming out and playing really strong, and Michigan with Harbaugh, and Harbaugh definitely lived up to the hype. Like, no, he didn't win a national title in his first season, but those were just being ridiculous. But he had a great showing and good strides, and even Texas made some good strides. Beating Oklahoma shows that there's some semblance of a future there. So. A lot of exciting things around, but if I had to put my ranking on the season, it would be 3-9, because that's how I feel.
3-9, another shot, please. Oh, yes. Well, we gotta wait for Andrew to connect back, but let's go ahead and move into our next segment. We're talking about the top 25. Are way too early predictions. Sorry, top 4, not top 25. Way too early predictions for next year. Tommy, why don't you go ahead and lead off if you don't mind?
Yeah, sure. So if we're going to talk about my top four for next season, at this point, if I had to guess who's going to make the playoff, I definitely think you have to look at Stanford with McCaffrey coming back and what they're able to do there. It's just a team that I would be looking out for. Their biggest hurdles are going to be that parity in the Pac-12 and just the fact that anybody can win on any given week. And they're not afraid to do that right now. I think Ohio State is going to – I think they're a little miffed about the games they lost this year. And I think they made the statement in the bowl game that they felt they should have been there. And, yeah, they've lost some key positions, such as Joey Bosa, but they're just restocking with Nick Bosa. His little brother is starting next year. So I think they're just – restocking and continuing to do what they're going to do. Oklahoma, you know, Baker Mayfield still got another year of eligibility left and possibly a second, I believe, if they can ever figure out what's going on with Texas Tech. So Oklahoma definitely is still going to be just as good as they were this year. And then the fourth team is probably going to be Alabama again. Just because, like we've been talking about Saban, I mean, he's just on a roll. He's got the players and the talent are there. His lines are just going to restack and keep going at it. So those would be my way too early top four this year.
I think that's pretty good. I mean, those are all pretty predictable picks. I was wondering if you were even going to put Bama in there. I was like, how is he leaving Alabama out? That doesn't make any sense. I'm a little curious. You put Ohio State in over Michigan?
I did. And I think Ohio State is a little more set in what they're doing. I think it's going to take Harbaugh another season to settle in before they really get to that Ohio State-Michigan game is going to be the clash that it was and that it hasn't been for such a long time. And I think Urban Meyer, like I said, they're just going to restack. They've got an incredible recruiting class coming in, and Nick Bosa, who apparently is every bit as good as his brother, is just going to step into that same role. So,
okay, well, Andrew just reconnected. We're talking about the way too early top four projections. I know ESPN has theirs. I know 247's got theirs. What are yours?
Clemson. LSU. Oklahoma. Tennessee.
Damn it. You're taking Tennessee from me. I like...
You guys have been watching way too much ESPN lately.
You've got an interesting projection there, because from my perspective, you didn't put in Bama. Is there a reason? Just they lose too much?
I think they're going to be breaking in a new quarterback. They're going to be breaking in some guys on defense. They're probably going to lose that entire defensive line. Now, Nick Saban's obviously shown that program just reloads. They don't deal with rebuilding. Or, in all honesty, a rebuilding year at Alabama is a two-loss season where you don't make the SEC title game. You know, to me, LSU doesn't have nearly as much to replace on both sides of the ball. I think they've only got one offensive lineman and I think maybe one defensive back. I think
and a grown man. And,
what?
And a grown man playing running back.
Yeah, I mean, you've got Fournette coming back. You've got all their wide receivers coming back. You know, I think the biggest thing is going to be that Les Miles went out and brought in Dave Aranda, the former defensive coordinator at Wisconsin, who is a fantastic young mind. It is definitely known as one of the, you know, Wisconsin was a top five defense this year. And the talent he's got at LSU was unbelievable compared to what he had at Wisconsin. I think he's going to be a fantastic addition to that staff and the conference. And, you know, I've got a lot more faith in what LSU has coming back than what Alabama has coming back. You know, I mean, I still say, you know, Alabama goes 10-2 or whatever and may still randomly make the playoffs depending on how much craziness happens. But LSU, in my mind, is got more coming back and looks better on paper coming out than Alabama does.
Well, and I think that's fine, and a lot of that makes sense in a way. I just think if you're looking at what the narratives you're going to see over the next few years is all they're going to talk about is Bama, 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 and how great of a coach Saban is. So I'm glad I got a different perspective than that, kind of from both of you, because Tommy put Bama in there, but I think he just kind of did it out of necessity in a way. Yeah,
I'm tired of betting against Saban, not doing it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, my thing is I thought of Alabama at 4. The thing to me though is I feel it's a little disingenuous to have LSU and Alabama in there, because you'd have to have a certain level of craziness for both of those teams to make the playoffs, and I just don't know if I see that happen.
Well, you did put in Tennessee, though. So you're saying Tennessee and LSU are going to make the playoffs?
Well, because if Tennessee's undefeated and their only loss is LSU in the SEC title game, you know, depending on yet again, in my mind, less craziness than would be necessary for an Alabama that doesn't win their division to get in.
Okay. I can...
You know, I mean, if Alabama's two losses are to Tennessee and LSU...
But then again, Stanford this year proved that two losses is all but a death knell.
I mean, it really just depends on who else wins and who else loses.
And it depends on who you lose to.
They lost to Northwestern. How much more of a quality loss can you get?
Because it says Northwestern on the front of the jersey. Because
it's a whole other podcast we don't want to
get. I mean, obviously. But, I mean, you and I both know that.
Let's stop before we get out of control here.
You can't respect a team whose color scheme is purple. And, yes, I do mean TCU. So. All right. So, my top four. First off, I'm just going to take Bama out of the equation because I am a Bama fan. And kind of like I was saying earlier, all you're going to hear from the major networks is how great Bama is and yada, yada, yada. Saban's a great coach. They're probably going to be in the projected top four for whatever reason anyway. So I'm just taking them out of the equation. I'm going to go with my top four other than Bama. So first off, Clemson. Clemson looked great. I think their only real challenge down the road is going to be Florida State. And I actually was considering putting Florida State instead. But Florida State's got this really weird situation at quarterback where I was not impressed in the Houston game. And it sounds like that's the quarterback that they're going to start. But
They've got a guy redshirted that they didn't want to pull the redshirt off just for the bowl game who's probably going to take over next year.
Here's hoping, because that was not good, and I know they're not going with Golson.
Golson's gone.
Yeah, Golson's graduating.
I don't know where he's going to go, though, in the draft. Anyway, so that's all.
He might not get drafted.
The way he played this year. Anyway, so Clemson out of the ACC makes sense to me. Big 12, I'm going to go with Baylor. And that's just because I like Baylor, really. I think they showed me in their bowl game something that really excited me that you don't see out of a lot of other teams, and that's versatility. They knew they had a bunch of injuries at quarterback, so what'd they do? They totally changed their game plan, went to a completely run-based offense, and pulled it off. A huge win against UNC. Now, I don't know that that's going to translate once you get back to the regular season. I think their coaching is great. I don't know about their talent pool, and again, they still got to go through TCU and Oklahoma. But for the moment, I'll put them in the top four. Out west, I'll go with Stanford. And Stanford's just another situation. They're losing a lot. But I'm looking at who they got to play against out there. And I don't think Oregon's going to be that great. USC always seems to struggle. And I think Stanford's just the most consistent team out there in the Pac-12. So if I'm going with an early projection, I'll go with Stanford. And then I'm going to go with Tennessee for all the reasons that Andrew mentioned. They're bringing back so much. I think they've got 9 starters on offense returning, 8 starters on defense, if I remember correctly. Their coach is doing great. They had a great performance this year. I think they went 9-3, and 2 of those losses were close losses, one to the national champion and another to a playoff team. So I think Tennessee's going to have a really good year next year and at least duke it out for that. And I'll give an honorable mention to Michigan because I think their recruiting pool is good. You don't have to raise your hand. Go for it.
Oh, I think the other big thing, too, is Tennessee went out and hired what, in my opinion, maybe the second best assistant hire this year. Is they went and pulled Bob Shoup the defensive coordinator from Penn State, who's definitely known as a great mind in the game. He's a Yale graduate. He's been with Franklin a lot. He was with Franklin at Vanderbilt and put together a really good defense there. I think he put together a pretty good defense given what he had at Penn State, and I think that's a hire that's definitely going to be a great one that's going to help Tennessee a lot on that side of the ball. Like I said, it's probably second best assistant hire that I've seen so far in the SEC.
Yep. Well, and the SEC has had so much in the coaching carousel. They've done nothing but improve. Well, except for at South Carolina, in my opinion. I don't know.
You know, as much as I still think that's a bit of a panic hire, I paid somewhat of attention to the guys that he went out and brought in as coordinators. I'm not completely sold on them. You know, I mean, South Carolina may do well enough to make a bowl game, but I don't see them really making a lot of noise in the East, not with Florida and Tennessee being where they are. And then, you know, Georgia's not going to lose too much. And I think that Smart was a good hire, and I think that he's done a good job in going out and getting his coordinators a lot better, in my opinion, than Muschamp's done at South Carolina.
Well, and I think part of that's just who they play against. I think they should be happy, though, that they're in a conference with Missouri, because at least they have something that they can compare to over the next couple of years.
Vandy and Kentucky.
Well, they're better than Vandy and Kentucky, even if they are terrible.
That's a guy that's going to be probably on the hot seat next year as Stoops at Kentucky. I think it's almost a bowl game or you're fired kind of season for him.
Let's move on to our next topic. And Andrew, I'm going to have you lead us off. Go through the recruiting update so far, recruiting on the season. Just to run us through, because I know you prefer the 247 ranking, so I'm going to go ahead and hand it over to you and let you read them off. Give us the top five classes right now in the 247.
So, first of all, I just want to go on the record as saying that I absolutely hate how commercialized recruiting has become and how it's become such a my team's better than your team because we signed X number of 4 and 5 stars and blah, 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 blah. And I think that it's started to create a lot of strange expectations and issues that not normally would have been there. That being said, the top five per 24/7 are LSU, Michigan, Ohio State, Florida State, and Georgia. I think you're going to see a bit of shakeup. Signing day is 3 weeks from tomorrow, as well as tomorrow ends the dead period in terms of coaches contacting recruits, as well as this next upcoming weekend. You're going to see a lot of official visits to get kids on campus, to show them more of the school, more of what it offers. And I think you've got a couple of big-time kids. Rayshon Gary, the number one recruit in the country, is still uncommitted. You've got the big defensive tackle out of Lanier in Georgia who's uncommitted. I mean, a bunch of guys that when and where they commit could have a huge impact on shaking up this top five, as well as shaking up some of the other ones. I know Ole Miss is in on a couple of these big-time guys that if they end up going to Ole Miss would definitely kind of push them a little higher up in the rankings. You know, I mean, recruiting is – you see a lot of consistency. You know, a lot of the teams that are going to be really good at recruiting are going to do it year in and year out. You're going to see a lot of the same teams in the top 10 and the top 15. You know, the top 25, you might see some teams flip in and out down at the bottom. But I think we're a little too over-reliant on these recruiting rankings and stars. I think that they can tell us some things, but I don't think they're gospel on the level that a lot of people kind of accept them as. I know I saw, and I'd have to go back and dig up the article, where someone looked at wins in relation to either Rivals or Scout, two of the other recruiting services, team rankings, and basically ranked teams on, all right, per your recruiting rankings, this is how many wins you should have, da-da-da-da-da, and then plotted them all to kind of show, all right, these teams win a ton more games with lower-rated classes. These teams win about the expected number of games. These teams win less games. And it was just interesting to see some of the teams that were really high in terms of maximizing lower recruiting rankings. I believe Georgia Tech and Wisconsin were two of the higher ones that get a lot more out of their their classes than you would really expect given where they're ranked. And I think that's the thing, too, is so much goes into winning and losing games that recruiting only tells you a small part of the picture, and I think too many people create a bigger picture from the rankings. It's, you know, I've always felt the guys that do these recruiting rankings, if they were that great, somebody would hire them on their staff. Someone would bring them in as a player personnel guy or something like that. As well as, it's really easy to watch tape and see guys like Leonard Fournette and Deshaun Watson and these high-profile guys that you can tell are head and shoulders better than everyone else. It's when you start to get to the next kind of step of players where there's small, minute differences, or you may not even be able to tell the difference between the, you know, the number 10 ranked running back in the country and the number 30th ranked running back in the country. I mean, you can watch the tape and see a lot of the same things. And so that's when you start having to see teams that are really, really good at recruiting to their systems, recruiting to what they're trying to build. You know, people always, one of the best examples was Jim Groby at Wake Forest, who knew he wasn't going to recruit the high guys. So he really built a strong program around recruiting guys that he could redshirt and he could develop into the system they wanted to play. You know, Georgia Tech does it to an extent. A lot of these spread teams have really kind of bought into that. All right, we're going to recruit the guys that can do what we need them to do, and they may not necessarily be the highest rated guys.
Well, and that's a smart way to do it, is to recruit to the system. I think, though, that there is an expectation if you're at these big programs to pull a lot of high-end recruits, because, like you said, it doesn't necessarily translate on the football field, but from a public standpoint, you want your fans to go and see, oh, they are doing their best to get the best recruits, and we will be better next year because we have the best recruits. But it doesn't necessarily translate. You're absolutely right. And a lot of these teams, they're consistently getting top-end recruits. Notre Dame, Georgia, to name a few, are not translating those into national title runs the way you would expect them to.
Well, the thing about it to me is if you're a team with less talent, you can make up for less talent with a great scheme. But a talented team with a bad scheme is probably going to lose to a lower talented team with a better scheme, almost outside of your talent gap being that big. And I think at the top levels, especially with your teams, like I said, they're consistently in the top 10 in recruiting, the difference in talent level is so small that it really does get to be a bigger deal of these five stars, but do they fit what we want to do? I mean, Alabama's done it fantastically on defense and pulling in guys that fit what they want to do on defense, and it's helped them a lot. Clemson's done it really well with Deshaun Watson, with the wide receivers and the running backs that they've pulled in on offense at Clemson. And I think that's the big thing, is you can recruit a ton of talent, but if they're not really able to do what you want them to do, it's really a waste.
Well, and also part of it, as we've brought up in the past, is also just keeping other teams from getting that talent, you know? The reason Miami had their big run kind of in the 80s and 90s is because they had that big recruiting pool right nearby, and teams kind of came in once they realized that was where all the talent was coming from. They came in and started taking all the recruits from that area, and that was a point that Nigel loved to point out. Tommy, you've been kind of silent. You got any thoughts on the matter?
Yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying, but I still think recruiting does matter. Maybe not to the level people talk about. I mean, if you're talking about the difference between the rankings of number one and number 25, it's not as big of a drop-off as it is during the regular season rankings. But if you're talking about the top 25 rankings versus when you get down to, you know, the 80s and area, I mean, you're looking at the names of the schools there, and there's a huge drop-off. I get what you're saying. If you're looking at this year's rankings and stuff, you'll notice somewhere in the mid-80s, you're getting San Diego State, Western Kentucky, Connecticut, Louisiana Tech, Kansas. And if you're recruiting at that level, you're not going to be able to compete with LSU, Oklahoma, Notre Dame, Clemson. It doesn't matter how good your scheme is, you're not going to be able to compete with that talent disparity. Now, there are people, that, like you said, that have performed above and beyond, but even still, those teams aren't winning national titles. I think in order to win a national title today, you have to have consistently a top 25, top 30 recruiting class year in and year out as far as the level of talent you're bringing in. So, yeah, maybe if we're looking at it, you know, LSU's ranked one, Michigan's ranked two. Oh, that means LSU did better. No, not necessarily. We don't know which is better, but it is important to pay attention to what people are doing recruiting and to see whether their scheme is going to be able to – they're going to have the players to run the scheme moving forward.
Yeah, I can agree with you on that. I think those are very, very good points. And yeah, you know, and like you said, there really probably isn't a huge difference between most of the teams in the top 25. Like you said, when you start getting that huge drop-off, that's where you really start to see it. Plus, to me, I really don't think that you can judge a recruiting class until 3 years later when you've really kind of seen how the guys have contributed, who's done what, who's redshirted, who's played, who's leaving early, who got kicked off the team. You know, I think that's much in the same way with drafts in the NFL. I think that you have to give it a couple of years before you truly see the impact of that class.
And sadly enough,
which to me is the polar opposite of basketball, where you will almost know immediately with a basketball class.
Yeah, sadly enough.
And that was going to be my other point, is it's almost the cumulative past 3 years of recruiting that means more than just this year's. But, you know, one bad year of recruiting can set you back or let you miss whatever that opportunity is. I mean, if you've got, you know, 11 of the 12 pieces on one side of the ball, you're still got that weak link. And if you can bring a freshman in that may not light the world on fire, but he can be serviceable and help close the gap from the guy who was playing there last year, that can push you over the edge to winning your division or winning your conference or getting that rival win that you haven't had before. So, yeah, it's not the end-all be-all, but it is something to pay attention to, and the recruiting ranking from 3 years ago is probably going to have more impact on this season than the one today is.
Which is the sad fact for Muschamp at Florida. I mean, you kind of saw how that turned out for him.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, McElwain won his games with Muschamp's kids. You know, I mean, that's what's going to happen in your first couple of years of coach. And then it kind of starts to ask the question of, okay, well, why didn't, you know, if you had kept Muschamp that one extra year, would he have had the same success McElwain had? You never know. The other thing about recruiting to me nowadays is talking about the commercialization of it now. You still will occasionally have the concept of the diamond in the rough player that no one's ever heard of. But because it's so focused and followed, and you've got camps all over the country, and you've got all of this, you know, you're talking about Miami. I mean, that's the big thing with Miami is everyone else started recruiting there, and I think you're starting to see that all over the country. You're starting to see teams really kind of move away. Most teams are still somewhat regionally focused in terms of who they'll get, but most of your big teams are still trying to go out to these other places and kind of cherry pick the best players out of some of these states. You know, the two states to me that it's most fascinating are North Carolina and Virginia, where you look at very rarely will the top kids in those states sign with an in-state school. Now, Virginia Tech did a really good job for a couple of years in Virginia, especially getting the kids out of the Tidewater area over in the 757 where the Vicks came out of and that kind of talent. But more recently, you've started to see the big SEC schools come into Virginia. You've seen Ohio State. You've seen some of the others. And then, I mean, North Carolina's always had trouble keeping the big kids home, and they've always looked to teams in the SEC, Clemson, Florida State, some of these other really good teams have really been able to go into these states and kind of cherry pick out the great players they wanted to augment what they're able to sign back home or closer. Or even you look at the state of Georgia, every team in the SEC recruits Georgia. Every team in the ACC recruits Georgia. The majority of the Big Ten recruits Georgia. You're seeing a little bit of the Big 12 come in, not so much. Stanford's made a home taking kids out of Georgia. There's a lot of talent that have come out of the state playing at Stanford. you know, Oregon will cherry pick a kid every now and again, but you're really starting to see on a huge scale the nationalization of recruiting so much more than it ever really was in the past.
I don't know what else we got to say about that. Dang. we got involved on that one. Shoot.
I got opinions, man. I think they need to be heard.
That's why we have this podcast. We're going to rename it to Andrew's Daily Rant.
I can't do it daily, man. I got an adult job and stuff.
So, there is one recruit I want to talk about before we sign off. Because I know the AJC is going to be talking about him for the next couple of weeks. Jacob Eason, how big of an impact is he going to make at Georgia?
I think enrolling early is going to help him. It's going to give him a chance, especially with Jim Chaney being the new offensive coordinator coming down from Pitt, which I think was a good hire. I think he's a good, especially that pro style that Georgia wants to run. You know, I expect him to be their day one starter. I really don't see anyone else they have on the team stepping in and beating him, as well as him coming in early and being as high profile as he is. You expect him to really not just be given the keys to the offense, but given every opportunity to outright win it. I think it's going to give Georgia a bit of a rough season, even with the talent they've got on offense, and hopefully Nick Chubb coming back to the level he was before. Sonny Michel, you know, the two-headed monster running back. I think they're going to have a lot of talent at tight end like they always have. I think wide receiver is probably going to be the big question. Terry Godwin really kind of came on later in the year to give him a bit of a vertical threat, but they've really since, you could argue Chris Connolly or Tavarius King maybe, you know, but even since A.J. Green, they haven't really had that big name, great, talented wide receiver to help them open up and stretch the field. You know, plus they lose a lot on defense, as well as you're going to be bringing in a new coordinator. You think the scheme will be somewhat similar because Pruitt was a Saban guy, but there's still going to be some growing pains in terms of that and some question marks. And they start the season in Atlanta against North Carolina. I think that's going to be a tough start for them. I think North Carolina is going to be a pretty good team next year, especially on offense, where they lose Marquise Williams, but the kid they've got, Trubisky's, played a good bit for him, has shown a bit better mastery of the offense and isn't really that Jekyll and Hyde that you've gotten so used to seeing out of Williams. You know, all the running backs are back. Quinshon Davis is a wide receiver they lose, but they've got some guys that can step really into his place. Matt Collins is back. Ryan Switzer is back. You know, I think they've got a chance. Now, their questions obviously are, after watching the Baylor game, they have to learn how to stop someone.
Yeah, that blew my mind. Like, that was the game that I think shocked, I don't want to say the world, but certainly the state.
You know, I think Andrew pretty much covered Georgia. I think the big-name recruit everybody needs to be looking out for is committed to Miami out of St. Thomas Aquinas, and that would be Michael Irvin Jr., big 6'3", 220 tight end coming in. And outside of just his name, putting a tight end of his stature with his ability, and if you haven't watched his high school film, it's pretty impressive to watch. But with Brad Kaya throwing to him, I think they're going to be scary. I think Miami's going to look good. And the other one to look at is Houston, who, if you look at their recruiting rankings and the teams that they're recruiting on the same level of, it's with Oregon and Arkansas and Oklahoma and Wisconsin and Texas A&M and Miami are all right there within about 7 or so spots. And this is, what, their third year in a row of bringing in a big recruiting class and third year in a row getting one of the big five-star high-profile guys. So Houston's really making a name for themselves to either be pulled into the Big 12 or just keep winning those at-large bids. And you saw them play against Florida State. I mean, they deserved every bit of that win that they got out of that. So that's definitely one of the schools I'd be watching in the future.
Oh, my God.
They'll probably get investigated in the next couple of years.
So we're going to have a death penalty situation all over again.
No, I don't think they'll get the death penalty because the death penalty is for repeat offenders while on probation. But, I mean, that's the biggest thing that you start to – you know, I mean, and I'm cynical about recruiting because I'm convinced every team in America cheats on some level. If you think your program's clean and it's not a service academy, there's some shadiness going on somewhere. But that really is something when you see a team like that hasn't recruited on that level often. You see the same thing with Ole Miss. Ole Miss gets a lot of accusations about it because they're recruiting on a top 10 level that they've never really done before. And so people are starting to go, wait a minute, what changed? Because very rarely in these kind of recruiting rankings do you see those monumental jumps.
They just started doing what everybody else was doing, I guess. That might.
No, I am 100% convinced every program in America outside of the service academies is dirty and shady on some level.
Well, to be fair, I don't think even the best of intending programs are cheating without knowing it, because the rules on recruiting are so outlandish, and even
understand it. To me, it's not knowing and not understanding the rules, because they're really not. If you dive down into the rule book, they're a little weird, but they're not that complicated. The bigger thing to me is I think that it's done without the staff's knowledge. I think a lot of it is create a level of plausible deniability. So if you do get caught, you're able to say, oh, it's just these rogue boosters. The head coach wasn't involved. You know, these assistants weren't involved. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. As well as you have to bank on the NCAA coming in and royally screwing it up like they did with the Miami investigation.
People,
in my mind, Miami was dead to rights. People, like, they were going to get slapped down. And the NCAA screwed it up. They botched it. They made a lot of mistakes. And so they obviously had to step back and go, well, fuck, what are we going to do?
That's the thing, is the more is this
they're
stuff.
They're going to take down North Carolina is what they're going to do.
No, they won't take North Carolina down, because to me, from reading the documents, in my opinion, this is not an NCAA impermissible benefits issue. It is a SACS, Southern Association of Colleges and whatever, that accredits university. It's a institutional academic dishonesty question, not an athletics academic dishonesty question, because it's a class that athletes and non-athletes alike took. And to me, it's not a – it was specifically designed. What's a bigger question to me in terms of athletic dishonesty is you look at a school like Auburn, where the professors got together – in their department and voted to end a major, and the athletic association found out about it and realized that the majority of their players were in this major. So they went over the department, over the college's head to the president and said, look, you don't need to get rid of this major. We need it. In fact, we will fully fund it if you need us to, which that to me is a way bigger red flag than what happened in North Carolina.
People have learned so much from all these old situations, like at SMU and like you said with Miami. It's kind of mind-blowing how good people are getting at bending the rules. Well, bending and breaking.
You know, there's the old joke, if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. So, you know, there's a lot of living in gray areas where, you know, technically you didn't say I couldn't do this, so...
Sounds about right. And I mean, like you said, plausible deniability. Well, yeah.
Which college football is not nearly as dirty as college basketball. If you really want to look at just recruiting shenanigans, college basketball takes the cake.
I'll have to check that out sometime. Oh, man. I do want to say before we sign off, y'all are making me really sad. Because all the great recruiting you're talking about, oh, Georgia's going to be good, Miami's going to be good. We have to play these guys, you know that, right?
Well, but, I mean, you know, I mean, we're pressed for time, but Georgia Tech faces a lot of issues recruiting that the schools we compete against don't.
For years.
Tommy, are you eating a cookie or something?
Maybe. Quit judging me, I went to spin class today.
Okay, I won't tell your wife. Sorry. What were you going to say?
I wasn't going to say anything.
Okay. All right. I won't tell your wife you're eating cookies.
Thanks.
You mean to be present what looks like Chappelle's Show? Don't you wrap it up, box me.
Okay, all right. Per Tommy's request, we're going to wrap it up. Really quick.
Wrap it up.
Really quick, I'm going to do I got a call out. I think got Pac-Man Jones. They're talking about Brown, who got knocked out in the Cincinnati game last week. And Pac-Man Jones is holding to the theory that Brown is faking it after getting knocked out because he winked at him while he was on the ground. And I'm not sure that he winked at him. If he did it, it wasn't on purpose. It was a bodily function kind of thing, I would imagine. But yeah, come on, Pac-Man, let it go. You lost, it happens. Any shout-outs, call-outs from you guys?
My only call-out is football season. You're over. That means you suck. So hurry up and start the new year so we have more to talk about.
Woo! Chinese New Year. Andrew?
I guess my my shout-outs again to Georgia Tech basketball. Beat number 4 Virginia over the weekend. It's a great win, and hopefully it's a win that kind of pushes us in the right direction, because that would be really kind of cool. I'm tired of having a terrible basketball program. Having grown up with really good Georgia Tech basketball, as well as a national championship appearance the year before I started college, I would like us to be really good again, please.
I'd like us to be good at anything. Well, we were good at women's tennis and everything.
Men's golf. We won like 11 of the last 12 men's golf ACC titles.
Baseball starts soon.
Oh, that's true. Baseball.
We're ranked in the top 25, as well as we had the number 4 recruiting class in the country.
Oh, in men's golf? No, I know you're talking about baseball.
No, in baseball.
Yeah, I know you're talking about baseball.
I'm super excited for baseball.
We should be pretty good this year.
Yep, we've developed a lot of guys really well. It looks like we might have a pitching staff, one or two guys.
We only lost one freshman to the draft, and he was the number 10 pick, so you know, you kind of expected that to happen.
All right.
That happens every year.
All right. I'm going to close it out. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you got any questions or comments, send us an email at toemeatleather@gmail.com. And I hope y'all have a good rest of the week. If you don't win the lottery, remember, you're just like the rest of us, so shut up and dance. Have a good night.